Good evening. Denny mentioned the typhoon and all in the Philippines. And I can tell you that all the ones that I know about, the people that I'm personally connected with, are fine. You remember the Morels that were here, Merles, about 2 years ago and held a seminar and had two daughters. But anyway, their brother, actually Brother Barry and his wife Sherry, are in the States right now. So they were fine, and all of their children that are still back in Cebu City are also fine. They didn't have any damage or any great problems. Most of the storm, it sounds like, hit over on the other island of Leyte, and quite a few people over there, I guess, have suffered. Now, the church is relatively strong in that area of Leyte. The gospel's been preached there for many, many years, a number of churches. So I'm confident we've got a lot of brethren who've been affected by this, but I'm sure we won't know for a little while anyway as to what is going on and who's been affected and all of that. I have talked to Letha today. She's doing fine. She's enjoying her job. And our son Matt, have not heard from him yet. He is, as many of you know, is over in Bixby, which is a suburb of the Tulsa area. And he is trying out for the job there, a pulpit job with that church. And this is his second visit, actually. So they've asked him to come back, which is always a good sign. And but there is another brother that they're also looking at, and they're bringing him back as well next week, I think. So we won't know whether Matt will be in Oki or not, but we can always pray, can't we? There's nothing like Okies. We need more of them. As I announced this morning, I want to take a look at something tonight that has troubled many a heart. In fact, for a number of people, this is something that has caused them to really not even be able to believe in the Bible's God and the God's Bible. And I want to look at the matter of God ordering the killing of innocent children with you tonight. Now, I realize this may not be a problem to many of you. In your faith and in your walk with the Lord thus far, you have been able to learn how to completely trust God, even in things like this that are difficult to understand. But even so, I would imagine that some of you would like to understand this better. And, you know, if the occasion arises, maybe be able to provide a better explanation for these things. What are we supposed to think and to believe? And how are we supposed to feel when we read in the Bible that God ordered the killing of innocent children? I mean, this is the same God who gave to Israel a law. And in that law, he said, "You shall not kill," or as some versions put it, "You shall not murder." In those occasions when God commanded the Israelites now to go places, to various groups of people, cities and so forth, and to utterly destroy every living thing, was he commanding his people to do something that he had earlier commanded them to not do? There are a number of instances where this can be found, where God commands his people to kill other people. Just a few weeks ago here on Sunday night, we were looking at a story that's found in the 15th chapter of Numbers, where a man was out on the Sabbath day picking up firewood or sticks, we assume for fire. The man was seized by his fellow Israelites. He was brought to Moses because they weren't sure what should be done with him. And we did observe that this surely was a case of intentional sin or presumptuous sin, as it's described in the King James Version, or sinning with a high hand, as it was said. And verse 35 says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'The man shall be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp.'" And the man was put to death because he, as was explained, despised the word of the Lord and broke one of his commands. Now, some of the other things for which people might be put to death included committing adultery, Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 10, or cursing your mother and father, Exodus chapter 21, verse 17. The same thing was also held for those who struck their mother and father. Bestiality was punishable by death, Exodus chapter 21 and verse 19. Doing any work on the Sabbath day was a capital offense, Exodus chapter 31 and verse 14. Offering your child as a sacrifice to the idol god Molech would bring about your death, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 2. Homosexual acts were to be punished by death, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13. Blaspheming the name of God, Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 16. Even coming too close to the tabernacle and the inner workings of the tabernacle when it was being taken down or put back up. If you got too close, that person was to be put to death. False prophets were to be killed. Now, the thing is that we sometimes read those passages and we maybe don't give it a whole lot of thought. But then we are shocked when we learn that Sharia law, which many Muslims live by, call for similar acts of capital punishment for things like that. And I'm not saying that the two are morally equivalent. I'm just saying, I want you to see why some people are deeply troubled and bothered by these things that the Bible points out to us. But our purpose tonight is to not look at generally the idea of people being put to death, but to look at the specific cases where innocent children were killed, and were killed at the hand or at the command of God. For example, we have the case of God ordering the killing of the people of Amalek, in 1 Samuel chapter 15. And of course, there's a background story to that. You remember, I think it's Exodus chapter 17, when the Israelites came out of Egypt. And they came to a place called Rephidim. They were looking for water, but there was no water. The springs or the pools or whatever had dried up. And that is the place where God told Moses to strike the rock. And so he did, and water came forth, and the people had water to drink and provide for their livestock and so forth. But while they were there, they were attacked by the Amalekites. And for a while, it looked like maybe the Israelites were going to be defeated by the Amalekites. But as long as Moses held his arms up, the Israelite army would prevail. And so Joshua and, Hur got under Moses' arms and held them up. And so that day, victory was given to the Israelites. But at that time, however, you probably remember, God promised that the day was going to come when he would utterly wipe out the memory of Amalek. And so, in the days of Israel's first king, King Saul, God sent word to King Saul that he was to go and take care of that matter. Let's look at verse 3 of 1 Samuel chapter 15. King Saul is told, "Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Now, I want to come back to that particular example after a while, but there are many other cases that are very similar to this one. For example, back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 2, Moses is recounting some of the experiences that they've had on that in that period of time that they've spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And in verse 26, he talks about what happened when, on one occasion, they wanted to pass through this region that was controlled by a king named Sihon. And Moses offered to pay the king for allowing the herds and the flocks and the people to pass through the land. He'd pay for the pasture. He'd pay for the water that was to be used. But Sihon refused. And then Sihon marshaled an army and came out against Moses and the Israelites. And in verse 33, this Deuteronomy chapter 2, Moses writes, "And the Lord our God gave him over to us." He's relating this now. He's reminding them of what happened. "And we defeated him and his sons and all his people, and we captured all his cities at that time and devoted to destruction every city, men, women, and children. We left no survivors." Over in the 7th chapter of the book of Joshua, when the Israelites were preparing now to lay siege on Jericho, they'd finally passed over the Jordan, and they were going to attack Jericho. In verses 16 and 17, we read, "And Joshua said to the people, 'Shout, for the Lord has given you the city, and the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction.'" And then dropping down to verse 21, we read, "Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys with the edge of the sword." A couple more chapters over, chapter 10, we read about another town named Makkedah. And Makkedah, the people there, had made the mistake of harboring 5 Amorite kings who had thought they could put together an army and defeat the Israelites from attacking them around Jerusalem. And so, but they were beaten, and the 5 kings who were leading that army fled to Makkedah and hid in a cave. And verse 28 says, "And as for Makkedah, Joshua captured it on that day and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He devoted to destruction every person in it. He left nothing remain. He left none remaining. And he did to the king of Makkedah just as he had done to the king of Jericho." In chapter 11, we read about the destruction of a place called Hazor. Verse 11 says, "And they struck with the sword all who were in it, devoting them to destruction. There was none left that breathed." And we could go on and on, really, just spend the hour just looking at all the examples where in which everyone in a town or a city or a group of people was put to death. Men, women, and children. Well, how are we to understand this? Especially when it certainly looks like a lot of innocent children were killed, and they're being killed at the direction of God. The same God who commanded the Israelites to not kill. Well, there have been several ways that people have tried to explain these issues or problems or conflicts. And there are some, I think, who have gone to the foolish extreme of talking about the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. And the God of the Old Testament, they say, was full of vengeance and wrath. The God of the New Testament, on the other hand, is a God of love and mercy. Well, of course, that explanation doesn't really work too well because there have never been two gods. Never been two gods. Both Testaments, Old Testament and New Testament, very clear about that. There is one God. And furthermore, speaking through the prophet Malachi in chapter 3 and verse 6, God says, "For I, the Lord, do not change." James chapter 1 and verse 17 says, "Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." Others have tried to soften the idea of the killing of innocent children on these various occasions as a kind of, if you will, a kind of mercy killing. After all, they say, those children died as innocents. And so they'll live forever with God and all of the saints. And there's certainly something to be said for that kind of idea. And furthermore, people might say, what were they to do? After all, you know, the mothers and dads are killed. They're gone. And especially the little ones, they're going to die anyway. They're going to die a cruel death. So it's kind of like that. Well, we can argue that way, but somehow it seems like an all-wise and all-powerful God could come up with something. Others have tried to explain the matter this way, that God was simply trying to prevent more bloodshed, more war, sort of like our justification for dropping the nuclear bomb or the hydrogen bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You see, by taking that drastic step that they did, it would put fear in the hearts of all the other people. And furthermore, you wouldn't have continuing generations of people wanting vengeance if you just utterly wiped them out. And of course, we realize that the Israelites, because they didn't do that, because they didn't, they failed to get rid of all the people of Canaan, that they had struggles and wars and problems the rest of their history in that land, still to this day. And then others might try to explain it this way. They say, well, you know, hey, God is God. And he can do whatever he wants to do. And that's true, isn't it? He is the potter, and we're the clay. In Romans chapter 9 and beginning of verse 20, Paul writes, But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honored use and another for dishonorable use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? And, you know, certainly from one perspective, it's true. We sinful human beings really are not in much of a position to set in judgment of God. And yet, from another perspective, we're not trying to do that. We're trying to understand God, trying to understand his word. And we're trying to understand why he apparently did, and for all we know, may still be doing what he forbids men from doing. We're trying to understand that if this book is inspired by God, and God is holy and just, how could he order the killing of innocent children? We think about what Herod did in Bethlehem at about the time that Jesus was born. And we think of that as a heinous crime. And it certainly was. So how can we continue to worship and praise a God who seems to have a long history of that kind of thing? And I realize that is an audacious question. But I'm telling you, there are a lot of people who are asking questions like that and not getting an answer that really satisfies or that makes sense to them. They're turning away from seeking after God. And we know that when they do that to their own harm. But can we not offer them something at least a little more helpful? Well, I hope we can. And that's what I want to try to do tonight in the time that we have remaining. First of all, I would want to begin by reminding people that all life, including human life, including the life of innocent children, is a gift. It's a gift from an omnipotent and omniscient God. It is His to give, and it is His to take away. That's why we are not permitted to take that matter into our own hands. The only people who are permitted to take life are those that God authorizes to do that. He authorizes governmental authority, according to Romans chapter 13. He authorizes those authorities and rulers the authority to wield the sword. Now, wielding the sword has a very specific meaning. They have the power to take life. And so they can do that. But when they do that, sometimes people are going to die. And sometimes innocent people are going to die. Furthermore, maybe others that are not government authorities or whatever, but God specifically tells them to strike and to kill certain individuals. They're authorized to take the life of others. And again, in those particular cases, there were undoubtedly oftentimes innocent children whose lives were taken. Keep in mind, however, that as we sang this morning, God moves in a mysterious way. And He knows what He's doing. Would you give Him that? And He knows what He's doing. There are things that God knows. Past, present, and future. There are things that God knows better than we ever could that makes whatever decision He makes or whatever action He calls for, that in every situation that is precisely that which best demonstrates His holy and just and loving and gracious purpose. God doesn't have to explain every decision to us. We probably couldn't understand it if He did. God doesn't have to justify every action on His part. But He asks us to trust Him and to trust that He knows what He's doing. I want you to think with me for just a few moments, and let me try to illustrate what I'm saying here. You remember the story of that involves or concerns Noah and the ark? Well, I'm sure you remember. Probably everybody's heard of that particular story. But do you remember why God decided to destroy the world? Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5 says, "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Now, think about the world then. And think about this. Do you suppose that there were any little children living in the world at that time. Any nursing babes at their mother's breast. Any little children running around playing in the dirt. Do you suppose there were any innocent children in the world at that particular time? There had to be, right? There had to be. I want you to think about this. Now, for their sake, for the sake of those innocent children at that time, was that a gracious call on God's part? Think about that. Given what he was seeing, and given what his omniscience told him would happen if he did not intervene, that decision was absolutely gracious. It was absolutely just to punish the wicked, but it was also absolutely gracious for him to reclaim those innocent lives that he had given in the first place. Life is a gift from God. And it is His to give, and it is His to take back, or to bring back to Himself. Now, with that thought in mind, building on the premise that God is both omnipotent and omniscient, I want you to see something else. And I tell you, so many times, people are like Job, you know? They don't understand, and they haven't got a clue as to what God is doing in the world. But they feel like they have the right to rake him over the coals for it. That's what Job did, wasn't it? Job was thinking to himself, I don't deserve this. Somebody got some transmissions and wires crossed up there. I'm being treated like an absolute heathen when I've done nothing all of my life except try to live and please God in every way. He said, I wish he would give me the time. Give me 3 minutes. I'll set the record straight. Well, finally God gives Job his 3 minutes. And Job sees whatever he saw in that conversation with God. And you remember what he said? He said, I think I'll be quiet. I think I've said enough. Read the last few chapters of the book of Job. There's so much that we don't know. But did you notice when I was sharing with you from the story of the Amalekites? And the battle or the fight with the king of Sihon and the people of that particular battle. And the people of Jericho and the people of Machidah and the people of Hazor and all of those other places as well. That in every case, it says the people were devoted to destruction. The word devoted there doesn't just mean that they were marked or that they were singled out for destruction. No. It means something else, something very different. And that difference makes all the difference in how we should view these situations, I believe. Do you remember what I read a little while ago in Paul's words in Romans chapter 9 and verse 22 when he says, what if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? We have to keep in mind that the soul that sins, it shall die. Ezekiel 18:20. The wages of sin is death. Romans chapter 6 and verse 23. Adam and Eve were told, the day that you eat the fruit of that tree, you will die. Well, They didn't die, at least not physically. So did God get it wrong? Did he make a mistake, or did he show mercy? Keep that in mind and go with me back to the Old Testament now. The story of Abraham, the 15th chapter of Genesis. Abraham, in the 15th chapter of Genesis, God, for at least the third time, is reaffirming his promises to Abraham that the land in which Abraham was at that time living, which was Canaan, that one day that would belong to Abram's descendants. Read with me, if you will, beginning in verse 13. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." What am I getting at? Well, what was God saying here to Abram about the people of that land? He was saying they were wicked. They were wicked people, and they were getting worse. And God was saying that the time was going to come when he would no longer put up with their wickedness, and that his judgment and his wrath were going to fall on those people. And so in God's judgment, these people were marked for destruction in exactly the same way that the world was marked for destruction in the days of Noah. And so when Moses and the Israelites bring the people of Israel back to that land, when they got even as close as that region where the king Sihon was located, these were a people that were devoted to destruction. That word "devoted" signified that which belonged to God. That's what it means. Go back to Joshua chapter 6 and look at verses 17 and 18 for a moment. Joshua is speaking to the people of Israel. They're about to attack Jericho. And Joshua says to them, "And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But you, keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it." Have you ever wondered, have you ever thought about why? Why didn't God just let Moses and the Israelites finish the job with the Amalekites when they were doing that? Why did he wait 400 or 500 years? Well, I don't know. But going back to 1 Samuel chapter 15, and look at verse 3 again. In the King James Version, you'll see the word "utterly." But that doesn't mean completely, as we use it today. That's the same word that is translated in other places as "devoted." The English Standard Version renders that, "Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." What was he saying? After being very, very patient with the Amalekites, for hundreds of years, God was saying, that's enough. Their wickedness was now complete. And it is time for His wrath and His judgment to fall upon them. They were marked for destruction. God was going to take care of them. But in that destruction, there no doubt were some who were innocent. Little children. Now for their sake, for the sake of those innocent children, you tell me, was that a gracious call on God's part? Absolutely. Given what He was seeing, given what in His omniscience He knew was going to happen if He did not intervene, that decision was absolutely justified. But it was also absolutely gracious. It was certainly just to punish the wicked, but it was also gracious on God's part to reclaim those innocent lives that He had given in the first place. Because life is a gift from God. And it is His to give, and it is His to take away. That's what Job said, wasn't it? The first chapter of Job. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Now, I hope this has been helpful to you. And if nothing else, I hope that it dispels in your mind any thought that God ever was or ever could be anything but fair and merciful and gracious to each and every soul. I think we would all agree that God has the right. In fact, God has a moral obligation to punish those who choose to live every way except His way, and in doing so, make the world a more and more perverse and dangerous place in which to live. So when God decides that it's time to bring an end to this world, to the universe as we know it, do you understand? It's His call. But don't you know that when that time comes, I'm talking about when the Lord comes back, there are going to be innocent children found all over the world, and God will be absolutely justified in making that call, at least for the sake of those little children who, as we say, are innocent in the eyes of the Lord. It'll be a gracious call. Let's close with this reminder from the Lord Himself, found in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 14. The disciples had been trying to discourage people who were bringing their children, and the Greek word actually implies they were bringing nursing babies, small babies, bringing their children to Jesus. And the disciples were trying to stop them from doing that. But Jesus said this, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven." I'd be interested in your thoughts or questions if you have things that you'd like to look at a little bit further on that. But I hope this has been helpful to you. If there's anyone here this evening who recognizes that in your own life there are things that are remiss and would like to take advantage of the opportunity that we have tonight, we're all together, brothers and sisters in the Lord. We can sing and pray for each other and encourage one another to the very best of our ability. If you need to come tonight for any reason, will you come while together we stand and sing?